Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Hello, buenos días. Thank you very much for coming. I know there have been some conflicts in the program, so we're very grateful to you dedicated fans here for making it, discovering where it was and also making it here. My name's Gabby Wood, and I am very pleased to be here with Owen Shears. 2 years ago, we were here in Cartagena. Together, we did an event together about, well, mainly about Owen's novel, Resistance, which you will be familiar with. And I'm amazed to tell you that in the intervening 2 years, Resistance has been turned into a film, we knew that bit, and Owen has produced two plays, a novella, a work of nonfiction, and a book-length poem, and also some of his poems have been collected and translated into Spanish by Andrés Neumann, the Argentinian novelist, under the title El Hombre Sombra. So, you know, an incredible amount of productivity in that period. He has absolutely no truck with any prejudice about genre, Owen. He has written so many different things in so many genres, and he never feels the need to call himself a poet or a novelist or a reporter or any playwright. He is all of those things. And he is, for my money, the most versatile, dynamic, and certainly the most enterprising author in Britain. And it's a pleasure to have him here. Please join me in welcoming him. So, Owen, should we, sorry, positioning slightly strangely. Should we begin by talking about Charlie F? It's a project many of you will know about. Owen did an event earlier this week about the two worlds of Charlie F, which, well, he'll tell us a little bit about the genesis, but it was about and also featured, starred, a play that actually included the performances of injured service personnel from Afghanistan. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how that began?
Yeah, sure. It was a project that, for me, I suppose, in many ways grew out of the theatre project that I'd been involved in just the Easter before that, which was a theatre project called The Passion, which was a very ambitious project. It was done by National Theatre Wales, and it was a 72-hour contemporary response adaptation to The Passion story, but set in a very industrial town in South Wales. So it was also very much an adaptation of that town itself, Portalbert. And the town was the stage for the play, really. It opened on the beach, and then over the next 72 hours, it was performed in the streets, in the shopping malls, in the social clubs. At the opening, at dawn on the beach, we had an audience of around 250. By the time we got to the Sunday night, the star of the piece was Michael Sheen. He was playing sort of this Jesus, a Jesus-type character called the Teacher. And I suppose the one thing with any sort of adaptation of the Passion play is that you know how it's going to end. And so the end of this production was Michael being crucified on a roundabout. And for that final part of the play, we had around 25,000 people on the streets. And
you crucify people in Wales and everybody comes to watch.
Well, actually, it's a very interesting point, because as the writer who had to sort of work both with the original story from the Gospels and, I suppose, in many ways, adapting the town, you realise that in any adaptation of the Passion story, there is this fascinating moment when the audience actually become the mob. Because those 25,000 people had not turned up not to see Michael Sheen crucified. They really wanted to see him crucified, you know. And you almost felt the air change, because you felt that they, I suppose, kind of felt, you know, complicit and involved in this act. And it was an extraordinary moment for me to be sort of standing in the middle of all that. But the reason that I mention that is because of the sheer numbers, there was lots of press about this play. And something I was always very keen to talk about was that every element of the script started, had it, its genesis with a story from somebody in the town. So the whole play had started with with just listening to people in the town. And a producer called Alice Driver heard about this, and the next week she phoned me up and said, I've got an idea. And her idea was both simple and also brilliant, I think, which was that she wanted to create a play that was based on the experiences of wounded service personnel and their families. But she wanted, crucially, to then put those soldiers on the stage. They would also be the cast. So the project was to be a recovery project first, really, a rehabilitation project, and a play second. But what really fascinated me about it was that a crucial part of the recovery was that it had to work as a piece of theatre. It had to be really, really good, because the only other thing we knew was that it was going on the stage of the Theatre Royal Haymarket in the West End. So the stakes were very high. And that was really, you know, where I came into the project. And I think I recognized it so even then that for a writer, it was a really unique opportunity, not only to talk to these people and their families who had so recently been through these issues and were still living them. I mean, the man who played the lead had lost his leg in Afghanistan only 5 months before I first met him. So just to listen and talk to these people was a real opportunity. But the other opportunity was that no one was telling me what sort of a play this had to be. You know, no one was saying it should only talk about this or it should only have this many people. So it was both terrifying, but incredibly exciting. Yeah.
How did you find those people? I mean, where was the cast from?
Well, we worked alongside the Royal British Legion, which is the main charity in Britain that works with wounded service personnel. And they had very recently set up 5 rehabilitation centres all over Britain. Actually, I say all over Britain, but not in Wales for some reason, which I was always annoyed about. And so we essentially went along to these rehabilitation centres. We stood in front of these people who, you know, most had been very, very recently wounded or were still, you know, very deep in the psychological wounding of their experience. And I should say that as many people involved in this project were physically fine but had very significant psychological wounding. And we said, in 2.5 months' time, we want to put on a play in the West End and we'd like you to be in it. And the responses were varied. They were the full spectrum. And it was interesting because the Ministry of Defence had told us, they said, well, we don't think you'll get anyone. And we had a policy that we wouldn't turn anyone away. And in the end, from those visits, we ended up with, I think it was around sort of 22 service personnel, who 15 of whom were involved in the cast, and then the rest were involved offstage in lighting, sound, and costume.
Why did the MOD think that you wouldn't get anyone?
It's a very good question. The honest answer is because I think that the higher echelons of the MOD think that they know the common soldier. They know the man on the ground, and I don't think they do.
So one of the things you discovered is actually the high command is out of touch with what's happening. Is that part of it?
I have to be careful what I say here, otherwise they might not let me back into Britain. But I think that they were as surprised as we were that so many people wanted to be involved, but they're not only that they wanted to be involved, but that they embraced this project so fully. And they really threw themselves into it and were incredibly generous with their memories and their experience. I mean, you know, the first time that I met them, I normally only had about a 45-minute interview with each of them. And I was asking them pretty tough questions straight away with the
what?
Well, I mean, you start off sort of asking for everyone's personal narrative, and it's quite interesting because the discourse of conflict, the discourse of experience of conflict is actually remarkably similar, and it has a very similar arc about, you know, why they joined, their expectations, and then quite often sort of a glossing over what happened to them. But you almost have to let that come out first. And then because we had such a short amount of time, and I felt very conscious that I was doing this, I was having to push quite quickly to ask, you know, what was it like to, when you first killed someone, what have been the most difficult consequences of your wounding since you've come back in terms of relationships and sexual contacts? Who do you feel that you've hurt because of your wounding? Who have you wounded in the process? And they were incredibly open and honest. And I think partly because a lot of them, it was still so recent. Obviously, I'm still in touch with all of the cast, and I'm pleased to say that through being involved in the play, you know, they've changed, they've become certainly more open and kinder people and softer. But as they've done that, a lot of what they've told me, they don't talk about anymore at all.
It's interesting. When you had your 22, were they people who knew each other? Or was there a moment when they all came together and was there a dynamic there that was interesting?
Yeah, there was an extraordinary day because a few of them, you might have had a friend who got involved, and that's, you know, how these things work. One person gets involved and says, no, you know, come on, please come and support me in this. But mostly they didn't know each other. They were from different regiments. They were different ranks. And we said that our environment in the rehearsal room had to be a rank neutral environment. Everyone was the same. So that was interesting.
And they behave like their ranks despite that somehow.
Well, they started off doing that. But then, you know, we had one major, and, you know, by the end of the third week, he was, you know, completely down with the guys and in the pub with them and loving it. I mean, I think the most significant part of actually his rehabilitation was being allowed to shed that rank. And just, you know, and he was a very interesting guy. He had a piece of shrapnel in his brain, which changed his personality instantly. And one of the most amazing interviews I did was with his wife, who said, you know, it's difficult because I don't like the person who my husband is now. It's not who I married. Mm. I'm going to stay with him, but it's like a different man has entered my life. And it was very painful for him because he would say that he would have moments when almost he was standing outside himself and he could see that he wasn't himself. But in terms of coming together...
I interrupted you, yes.
Sorry, the rehearsal room is a very powerful place to try and sort of instill a very immediate coherence. But of course, we were working with people who understood this. And I think one of the first things that worked for them, because a lot of them have been very isolated over the last 18 months. You know, most of the marriages have broken down. They weren't able to see their children because they were on too much medication. So to come into a room and to realize that they had this huge obstacle, in 6 weeks' time we had to put on a play, it was only going to work if they pulled together, if they got to know each other, and if they didn't let each other down. And of course, this kind of triggered a very familiar feeling for them, because this is what their life in the institutions, in the army, had been like. Mm. And as a writer, there were some interesting things you could play with. The director, Stephen Rain, and myself, we both knew from the start, we didn't want this to be a piece of verbatim theatre. Mm-hmm. We didn't just want to put the interviews on the stage, because this was all about challenging them. And if you see the play, you'll see that we asked them to sing and dance, and, you know, there are jazz hands and everything. So we asked them all to choose a name for their character. And so, again, it was part of the recovery process. Although they were telling stories on stage very, very close to their experience, the character was just here. Mm-hmm. But that distance was vital. It was everything. And something I realized I could play with is that sometimes I could give someone else, you know, their friend's story, and you suddenly saw them really take ownership of it. I think, okay, well, I have to get this right. I have to learn these lines because it isn't mine, it's his.
That's interesting. That sort of appropriation of someone else's experience must have helped them in a way with their own, because you get the, what do they call that in film, the reverse angle shot, you know, that you somehow... Yeah. Are able to absorb more because you've got more sort of multiple perspectives. Is that something you found?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, understandably, a lot of these men and women have had a very difficult time since they come back with everything I'm talking about, but also just the frustrations of the system. You know, not perhaps getting the right, you know, not seeing the right specialist. They've been through multiple operations. Things weren't working. When that happens, you know, the vision can come completely inward. Mm. So to be in a room where not only do people share that experience, but there are varying degrees of the severity. So, Dan, this young guy who lost his legs at 18, and yet was incredibly sort of, had somehow absorbed that experience very successfully. You'd see some of the other people with perhaps less severe injuries, but who'd still had a very hard time sort of watching Dan and going, well, okay. Yeah, so I mean... You know, it's like everything in literature, in theater, I think what art can bring to these situations is the concept of empathy. And you know, it's empathy that lies at the source of everything, at the source of good writing, but also I think at the source of these kind of projects.
Were you confident that art would be enough, or did you have a therapist working with you? I mean, were you worried that the things that came out might actually harm them in some way, that the process was, that you were unprotected in the process?
I must admit, I was very concerned about this. We did have an army psychologist sort of in the wings, but he ended up never getting involved. Even though several times I said, you know, could you just come in and check, you know, that I'm not sort of ruining everything. So, you know, I think we'll be the first to admit it was a bit of a high wire act. It was a project with high risk, but that was what also made it worthwhile. What I did find that was interesting was that after those initial interviews, my main method of research, actually for the first 3 weeks of the rehearsal, so we still didn't have a script after the first 3 weeks, which was my fault, I'll admit. But, you know, I was still absorbing. But the main method was to hold these group conversations. Mm-hmm. And I would throw a subject, which I would have gleaned from those earlier conversations. So throw a subject like sex and relationships into the room and then allow them to talk. And it was very powerful because normally one person would sort of break surface and would say something very honest. And out of the corner of your eye, you'd see all of these nodding heads. And it was only afterwards I learned that although they do have individual therapy, they'd never had any group therapy. Mm. So, yes, it was certainly risky, but that was a huge leap forward in the project.
Oh, interesting. I think it would be good to see a bit of this, and we'll return to it afterwards, but we have a short clip of The Two Worlds of Charlie F., so we'll just play it now. It's a film of a play, so...
Yeah. And if I should just explain where this comes.
Yes. Sorry.
There's been a brief scene at the start, which was a very common thing that many soldiers told me, that when they come round in hospital, they think they've been captured by the Taliban. So that scene's... just happened. What you'll see now is the opening speech by the main character, Charlie.
How'd they get you? I'm gonna fucking murder you.
Can we? Oh. Fingers crossed.
Stop!
We're still seeing Owen. Owen can perform it himself, but oh, something is happening here. You can hear it, I think, possibly, but not see it. Ah, here we go.
Do you remember that feeling when you fell off your bike when you were a kid? Do you remember that pain?
Can we turn it up, please?
The one that you don't feel right away. Then you look down at your hands and your knees and they're all shitty and gritty from where you bounced along the pavement and it starts pulsing. And you're like, ow, 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 what the fuck? That's what I remember, that kind of feeling, that grit in my hands, my knees, and my mouth, that smell of Afghan, just shit and dust. Shit, skin flakes, and sand. That's what I remember. I don't remember waking up. I don't remember eating breakfast. I don't remember getting orders or loading up or leaving the compound. I don't remember where we went. I don't remember going into an archway, a low archway. I don't remember an IED going off. None of it. What I do remember is taking my poncho down because there was a helo coming in that night, and then getting into my trench on my shitty little deflated air mattress and staring up at the stars, those Afghan stars, which, let me tell you, are like no other fucking stars anywhere else. And then getting tortured by the Taliban for 3 weeks. If anybody says that coming out of a medically induced coma is fun, they are fucking lying. So yeah, I realized I must have looked like a class 1A fucking asshole back there, but you gotta realize that when I woke up, I wasn't in a hospital bed. Okay, yeah, I was in that bed. And according to my fiance and my parents, and my family, I was there. Their Charlie was back, but at the same time, I wasn't. That round light above me. It was an observation hole. And hospital screens were a temporary Taliban holding cell. And the nurse, she was a devious Taliban interrogator. And the pain and the tubes, that was the torture. And I'm Henry VIII AM, I don't have a fucking clue. I didn't even know there was more than two lines of that song. Look, when British soldiers were injured in the Napoleonic times, it would take them months to get home, if they did. In World War I, take weeks. In World War II, about the same from France, and even longer from Africa, Egypt. But now, Nadi Ali north to Bashing in 20 minutes, and back in the UK, 12 hours, 13 tops. But up here is even quicker. I mean, like, blink of an eye kind of stuff, insta-fucking-taneous, with some high-definition hallucinations thrown in just for shits and grins. The problem is when you come back that quick, not all of you comes back at once, and no, I'm not talking about the fucking obvious either. Right, before we go any further, I can see that more than one of you out there has got the exact same question. What the hell kind of accent is that for a Royal Marine Commando anyway? Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it's fucking Canadian. And don't you ever fucking forget it. Nor the Trinidadians, the Fijians, or the Gambians, or the Gurkhas. Oh yes, thanks to your over-industrious forebears, we're all in this Afghan shit together. As citizens of the Commonwealth. And now, for the very brief time that we all have together, so are you. So you ready? Should we get started? Let's go on a let's go on a tour. PO 56085 Mike, Corporal Charles Fowler, age 27, B Company 22 Commando, Royal Marines. Injured in Nadi Ali North on the 28th of May 2011.
2504498, Rifleman Leroy Jenkins, age 20, 4th Battalion of the Rifles. Injured in Helmand Province on 26th July 2009 by an IED.
542711, Major Daniel Thomas, age 38, 2nd Battalion Royal Welsh. Injured by an IED strike whilst...
2522-3563, Sapper Richard Booth, age 21, 9 Parachute Squadron, Royal Engineers.
P063793 Golf, Corporal Frank Taylor, age 25, Royal Marines. Injured on the 1st February...
2588-6967, Corporal Roger Smith, age 37, 2nd Battalion, Princess of Wales Royal Regiment.
2503-1076, Sergeant Di Baker, age 37.
2505-1100, Bombardier Darren Sobey, 34, 26 Regiment, Royal Artillery.
2523-4412, Lance Corporal Chris Brown, age 21, Coastline Guards. 2510-8692.
I think we can fade that out.
2516-3768, Corporal Mark Anderson, age 24.
W104-2163, Lance Corporal Simi Yeh.
Thank you. Gracias. Thank you. Lights up, maybe. Thank you.
Thank you. Muchas gracias. Yeah.
That's incredibly moving already. What can you tell us about that central actor?
Yeah, Cassidy Little, an extraordinary man. The first time I met him, I went down to a place called Headley Court, which is where most of the British service personnel will go either straight after they arrive back from Afghanistan or shortly after. It's a very beautiful 1930s house out in the countryside. And I must admit, I've always felt that anyone who votes should go there, because you step into this place and it's extraordinary. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young men and women with all sorts of awful injuries. And it was there that I met Cassidy, and he was high as a kite on his medication. He was absolutely out of it. But he was sort of listening in on us explaining that we were going to be doing this theatre project, and he just sort of latched onto it. And he said, yep, I'll do it. I'm in. I have to do this. And so we found out he'd actually first come to Britain to try and launch a career as a stand-up comedian. as he always says, ironically, now that he only has one leg. But there was lots of black humour in the piece. But it was because of that, because then when that didn't work, he ended up joining the Marines, and where he was a medic. He actually trained the two guys who ended up saving his life. But it's a good example, I suppose, of how a project like this works. Because I knew he'd at least, you know, tried being a stand-up comedian a few times, that I knew that there was one thing he could do, was that he could stand on that stage and he could talk straight out there to you, and he could hold the stage. And that was wonderful for me, because it meant that, I mean, with these sort of projects, everything has to respond to what you find. And I said earlier that I didn't know what sort of a play this was. So the people who I met started to shape the play. So Cassidy really shaped the play, because I thought, right, we'll have a central character. At various moments, he can stand up and he can break the fourth wall and he can talk to you. And he can sort of pin the narrative of all of these other people's stories together. Mm. And so that's Cass. And I'm very pleased to say that he's actually now pursuing an acting career, a professional acting career.
Very good. Now, I want to move on to some other things that Owen has done. But before I do that, I mean, I think in all this discussion about how you came to write it and the actors and so on, we're sort of underestimating just the ambition of the project. I mean, the fact that this thing exists, the fact that it was in the West End in London, the exceptional nature of that. I mean, what do you hope will come of it, or what has come of it? What are the sort of repercussions and consequences of that?
Yeah. I mean, considering that performance that you just saw was almost exactly a year ago, the last year has been quite extraordinary, because there were only ever meant to be two performances of this play, because you know, no one knew if it would work and also how the audience would react to it. I'm pleased to say that the first two audiences who saw it, you know, were standing ovations. They were incredibly positive. And the press was also very kind. The Telegraph gave it 5 stars. Thank you very much. But all of that was very significant, because I think, you know, myself, Stephen the director, Alice the producer, we had a taste of what this you might do. But until the lights came up and that cast saw an entire theatre stand and applaud them, I think that they hadn't realised what they were doing. And it knocked them for 6. And then when they woke up the next day, actually, and they read that review in the Telegraph, it literally meant the world to them. You know, one of the cast mothers came to me recently and said, thank you, I've got my son back. I'd lost him for 2 years. But what got him back was that reaction, as much as the project itself. So because of that, we toured it last summer. We took it to Cardiff and Birmingham and then up to Edinburgh, where amazingly it won the Amnesty International Freedom of Expression Award, which again, for these people, was another stamp of approval. So we hope that the play will continue in Britain, but what we're really interested in now is how can we export this model to other countries to enable other theatre companies in Mexico, in Colombia, elsewhere, to create their own plays about conflict, performed by those wounded in the conflict. And something I'm always very keen to say about this is that our production, it happened to be quite military, because at the moment in Britain, those are the people who are being wounded. But I think we're very keen that each country should shape the play to suit their situation. So it should be a model that can involve, you know, civilians, adults, children. And so we're in the early stages of talking with a few groups in Mexico about bringing the play over as a way of launching a Mexican version. And I've already had a few conversations with people here about doing the same here.
Is there an ultimate political intent there in terms of ending the conflict? Or, I mean, what is the overall hope in those terms?
Well, there's a speech of Charlie's at the end of the play where he says, you know, that although they're all leaving the army, they're joining the largest regiment there is, which is the Regiment of the Wounded. And it's recruited from Britain, from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Mexico, you know, men, women, children. And as he says, you know, until we stop fighting, it's going to keep growing. Now, I'm not going to be so idealistic to say that this play is going to stop conflict. But as the writer, what I wanted to do was to put a very unflinching gaze, the truth of conflict and the consequences of conflict, and how far they spread through families and through children. I wanted to put that on the stage. And I think if you do that, you don't have to be political with a capital P. Of course.
Although there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, there isn't anything wrong with it, but as a work of theatre, as a work of art,
right.
it can be a failing. If an audience feels that the play is doing this at them, mm. you know, people are going to back off. No one wants to be preached to. If you present it, and if you have the opportunity to present it by those who have been affected, those who are wounded, I think it's an incredibly empowering moment. The most common comment from audiences in Britain on Facebook, on Twitter, was, every politician should see this play. Mm. Mm. When we brought the play back to London, we invited politicians from every party. No one came.
That's an achievement in itself.
That's what
surely.
I'll say. And I suppose I'll just finish by saying, but obviously my aspirations for having other countries do this is, yes, I would love at a G20 meeting one day to bring 8, 10, 15 plays performed by the world's wounded and just perform them. Mm.
Just show it and not tell it, yes.
Just show it.
Very, very different work, of course, but Resistance is a novel set during the war in a sort of alternate reality, fictional in many senses. It's a novel, but also the events that that it's based on never happened. Have you thought about your own preoccupation with war, whether you have a sort of consistent one, whether it's evolved? What is that about?
I know. I've been asked this a lot, because there once was a time when I thought about joining the army, but that was a very brief time because I realised I couldn't ever cope with someone telling me what to do. But
that's the only reason, yeah.
Well, there is a more fundamental reason, which is if you're in the army, your job is to not question, most of the time, which was kind of counter to my natural flow. But it's something that's grown organically through my work. It hasn't been intentional. Mm. I suppose I can perhaps trace it to, I had one job as an actor. That was the entirety of my acting career. But it was playing Wilfred Owen, the First World War poet. Oh. And I became very interested that we still teach the First World War in Britain through the poets, but we don't ever talk about the Second World War poets. So I wrote a play about a wonderful poet called Keith Douglas, who fought in the Second World War. Another play about Alan Lewis, a Welsh war poet and a short story writer. And so I suppose along these projects, I was becoming increasingly interested. And one of the main characters in Resistance, Albrecht Wolfram, the German captain, is essentially a man who is suffering from PTSD. He's suffering from combat stress. He wants to forget the soldier he is and rediscover the man he was, which is what most of these people want to do. And so you're right, it has been something of a preoccupation. But even with these historical projects, I'm aware that I've been drawn to them because of what's happening now. And so the most simple answer is, for the last, 12 years, we've been involved in conflict. I've been reading about it. I've known friends in the British Army who have dealt with all sorts of issues. And I think so, as long as we keep doing it, writers will be writing about it. And I think I do feel that as a modern society, we have an ability to actually live at a great distance from the reality of those conflicts. Mm. And sometimes, historical novels are actually a way of bringing some of those realities, some of those questions very close to home.
Mm. Pink Mist, which is the verse drama that you've just written, not yet published, grew out of the work that you did on Charlie Hebdo. How do you feel that listening to the voices of these other people has affected your own writing?
I think it affected my writing hugely. When you listen to that many stories, and you get a very strong sense, it was something that Colin McCann spoke about a few days ago, is that people have a real need to tell their story. Young people who quite often have left school at 14, 15, they've quite often joined the army because they're leaving something else. They're leaving a very difficult situation at home, that kind of thing. They don't necessarily have the tools to express themselves. So to have heard so many of these stories and to have have people look you in the face and say, look, we really want to be heard. And I want my mother's story to be heard. And I want my girlfriend's story to be heard, because that's who I've hurt. You know, you can't not be affected by that, and you can't, you know, not react. I did go through an interesting period when I was working on Charlie F, where I realized that I was angry. I was just walking around angry. I was going to a dinner party at a friend's house, and I was angry at everyone. So it affected me on a very personal level in that way. In terms of Pink Mist, I still had quite a lot of material and stories I hadn't been able to put into Charlie F. In the play, you know, as I said, I was writing towards very specific characters. So Pink Mist was actually commissioned as a piece of radio drama. So it's a verse play for voices, in which I was able, I suppose, to move slightly further away from this purely responsive form of writing, and to re-engage with, I suppose, you know, myself as a poet, and to distill these stories and to invent and to hopefully invest them with more meaning by sort of making this imbrication, you know, this blending of art and real life, I suppose, even more intense. So it's felt like a real privilege, because I've been given access to material, to voices, to an entire vocabulary I wouldn't normally have had. I do think now also that it's enough.
Well, hang on. You said that earlier, and then you said, unless someone wants to send me to cover a war.
Well, I know. I did find myself saying that. I was very struck. During the Bosnian conflict, The Guardian sent the poet Tony Harrison to the front line for 2 weeks. And he wrote some extraordinary poetry there. And I was aware that I've read pages and pages of journalism about that conflict. But actually what I remember is one of his poems called The Red Bicycle, about watching a Serbian militia come back from this town that they'd sacked, and one of the men holding this red bicycle that he'd obviously brought back for his child, but that had obviously been taken from someone else's child. And so I did rather rashly say over breakfast, I feel as though I've been writing about this subject from other people who have been there, and maybe the next obvious step, although my fiancé won't thank me for saying this, is to actually go there and be there.
Oh, you see, you care for what you wish for.
I know.
I want to leave some time to let you ask some questions, but also I want to ask you about a subsequent book. Well, they're all about to be published, Calon, about the Welsh rugby team, which perhaps is not all that different.
Yeah. It was something that I embarked upon because I hoped that it would be very different, and in many ways it was. For the last year, for 2012, I was lucky enough to be the artist in residence for the Welsh Rugby Union, so for the Welsh rugby team. Now, as someone who has supported the Welsh rugby team since the age of 5 or 6, and someone who used to play rugby, this was like, you know, being a child in a sweet shop. You know, you know, they wrote to me to ask me, and I think the reply came in about half a second later. Yes. When? Where do I start? but I did also think it would be a very different world to enter from this world of conflict. And in many ways it was, but the more time I spent with the Welsh rugby team, who are very young, are a very similar age to these soldiers, you know, 19, 20, 21, I realised that there was a huge amount of shared territory between these worlds. These were two, you know, very stereotypically a masculine and physical monocultures. And yet because of that, these young men actually live incredibly fragile lives, because it can all end instantly. For the soldiers through wounding, or for these rugby players through injury, they never know if they're, you know, they might be 20 years old, but they might be experiencing the peak of their experience now, and it might, you know, end next week. So it was interesting to trace those similarities. But, you know, it's also, essentially a piece of, I hope, you know, literary sports writing, literary non-fiction. And as with any of these projects, I think what you try and do in these situations is to approach it as a stranger again, to try and see, you know, rugby and the world of rugby with completely new eyes, to ask some questions about why in Wales this sport is almost a national insanity, and because of this obsession with rugby, the pressure that is put on these young boys is unbelievable. Mm. And I suppose in the light of that is to really get under the skin of the human story, to really just to try to write about what it's like to be a 19-year-old boy from a very small village who is suddenly running out in front of a stadium of 80,000, a TV audience of millions, and is being expected, you know, to win for their country. There's something incredibly ancient about it as well. The more time I spent with them, I found myself thinking about, you know, gladiators and the, you know, I suppose the, you know, the Greek arena, and even, I suppose, the very earliest Welsh poetry was, you know, poetry written in praise of the warriors, or actually quite often elegies for fallen warriors. And I couldn't help sometimes thinking, as I stood in the tunnel, you know, with this huge team in front of me about to go out onto the pitch, that there was kind of an interesting link between these this very 21st century experience and these, you know, 6th century poems.
Gladiatorial combat. Yeah. Calon, the book's title, tell us what that means.
Yeah, so Calon is the Welsh word for heart. And exactly the same as in English, you know, that both means the actual heart and the metaphorical heart. And I suppose talking about this link that Welsh rugby has with the past, one of the things that I discovered is that they think very carefully about their shirts, you know, their armour, their uniform, whatever you want to call it. So the numbers on their backs are actually comprised of thousands of photographs of fans' faces.
Really?
So they literally play with the fans on their back. Extraordinary.
Amazing.
And every season they have a new word in Welsh stitched on the inside of their collar. And the first word they had was Calon. And so I knew that I wanted to call the book for that reason, but also because that stadium, that team, it does, you know, for right or for wrong, it lies at the heart of Welsh, you know, psychology, I think. But it was also about having a nod towards that historic link, you know, to play with this very ancient language inside your shirt.
Hmm. Well, we look forward to that. I should give you a chance to ask some questions, although there are many more I'd like to ask. But if anyone has one, there are some microphones at the side. Please put your hand up. También pueden hacer preguntas en español si quieren. Anyone? Oh. Thank you.
Thank you. We saw your play of Two Worlds of Charlie F. on Thursday. And we were profoundly moved. I think it will stay with us for a long time and change the way that we think about disability and war trauma. And you mentioned that you're working with Mexicans, and I was wondering if you have any access for people who don't speak English to be able to see part of the play or to on the internet. Is there anything in Spanish that Colombians could see?
Well, thank you very much, firstly. There's not yet, but that's really the next step, actually. From here, I fly back to Mexico City, and we're talking with the Anglo-Mexican Foundation and hopefully the British Council as well. And I think the first step is to have a version of this play with Spanish subtitles, and certainly to put as much of that as possible onto the internet. And I think that's what's so interesting about this model. Is that the first thing that should happen in whichever country we go into is that it has to be translated. And then it's about very much putting the idea out in a way of saying, look, that's what we did. But, you know, taking the essential idea, you should then do whatever you want. There's all sorts of, you know, I suppose, mentoring and advice that we can give. So I'm not quite sure what we're calling it yet. It might be a foundation or something, but we are certainly very keen to create a body. And I think an awful lot of this, you're quite right, will happen online. I think it's got the potential to create a really astonishing online community where these castes can start to talk to each other. Mm. I know that the men and the women who are in this play are really evangelical about wanting to be involved in other productions and helping. And it's interesting, there's all sorts of advice. I mean, you know, I mean, as a writer, I'd say that, you know, jokes and humour are nice in any play. In this play, they were absolutely vital. They they had to be there. We had to have the audience laughing as much as they were crying. And, you know, so I suppose that's just an example of the kind of thing that I would pass on. And I'm sure that, you know, the director, he was a very experienced director, Stephen Rain. He actually might be involved because he speaks Spanish, but I know that he went on a learning curve like that, and he just feels that he's got so much to tell other directors about how to work in this field.
Mm. That'd be interesting. Yeah, sorry, the question at the front there.
Thank you. We also saw the play a few days ago, and we're very, very moved and impressed. Would love to be able to see it in person. A question I wanted to ask is, in your comments today and a few days ago, you emphasized so much the issue of recovery. Mm. And wanted to know, in that process, how much of the recovery and thinking about the people that they hurt in the war and the issues of being in another country and the tragedy that Afghanistan is living as a result of that war.
You know, it's a very good question. Are these questions being translated, by the way, into Spanish?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you. You know, it's a very good question. And it was one of the most interesting journeys that people went on because initially, I mean, let's not lie, you know, the cast I was working with, an awful lot of them were not saints, you know. There was quite a lot of racism and sort of some very, very specific ideas. And that's for all sorts of reasons. It's either because that's the only world that they've lived in, or they needed to believe that what has happened to them has happened for a reason. But yes, you start talking to them, and especially psychologically, what I found is what these people are really affected by is not just the damage that's been done to them, but certainly the damage that they have done. And I think it's a conversation that we don't have enough in Britain. It was interesting that Prince Harry was just given a hard time because he talked about how he'd fired at the Taliban and that how he, it wasn't a great phrase. He said that he'd taken them out of the game. It's a pretty awful phrase, but it's a very typical military phrase. But then he was criticized for saying that. And I thought, well, actually, that's what happens. We do need to talk about it. It's interesting, when the script was sold, the proceeds from the script are going to a school in Afghanistan. And that was a choice that I made. And it was interesting because that was the first time that the subject was properly broached with the cast. Because a few of them said, why are you doing that? You know, shouldn't the money be coming to our charities? And we had the conversation and they very quickly said, well, no, actually, yeah, we can understand that. And actually, it sort of went full circle because then they realized, you know, what actually gives meaning to their injuries is if Afghanistan is, you know, back on its feet as soon as possible. Schools like the school that this money is going to can educate women. And ideally, I mean, God, it seems almost impossible, but a project like this, I would love a project like this to happen in Afghanistan with, you know, an Afghanistan, you know, writer, director. It's a very pertinent question, and I think it's the element of the subject that is going to have the longest legacy. And it's partly because it's a conversation that we don't have. I mean, to put it bluntly, I was walking into a rehearsal room every day where the cast had killed a lot of people. And we just don't think about that, you know, we're asking some 19, you know, 20-year-old, you know, boys to do this. And obviously someone would say that is war, but yeah, it was an important part of the recovery, but I would argue that's the part of the recovery that is still actually ongoing for them.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, one at the back. If you, I'll come back to you too. If you just hold on for the microphone, thank you.
Yes, thank you. This has been fascinating. I was wondering. Since the play is a lot about healing, did you ever consider having family members within the cast? Would you advise that? Do you think that would be wise if this is to be recreated somewhere else?
Well, the short answer is actually yes. Yes, I think that would be a wonderful idea. And I should have said that in this cast, it's always very important, and I always forget to say it, that the soldiers were working along five actors. So there were five actors, and three of them were women. So in the in the cast, they were performing the roles of mothers and girlfriends and wives. So certainly those voices were there. And in Pink Mist, the poem, the other reason I wanted to write that is that I wanted to put a lot more of the women's voices in there, because those were some of the most extraordinary interviews I had. People who are still bearing the brunt of conflict every day now, but have an extraordinary perspective upon it. As to if they should be involved in the cast, again, I think, you know, every country should shape this play to suit their situation, but I think it could be it could be very powerful. There's an interesting coherence which comes with a rehearsal room where everyone is wounded. That's the only thing I'd say, is that there's a very interesting bonding that happens there. So the point at which these people enter the process is, I would argue, something that would have to be thought about, probably. But their voices should be there, because, as I said, these are the people who are really experiencing it every day.
Thank you. There was a question further forward. Yes, if you... okay.
The question is, why did you choose to write about conflict and injuries and trauma and the soldiers and what they feel? Is there any personal reason in your life? Is maybe you talk about it, but I didn't hear, or why this issue, why this theme?
There's certainly no personal reason. I mean, I don't have any family members who have, you know, suffered in this way or who have dealt with these issues. I certainly have friends from school who joined the army, and I think that you hear sort of anecdotally about, you know, certainly an awful lot of, you know, ex-service personnel committing suicide, and an awful lot of homeless on the street. I think I'm just interested in it because it seems to me to be sort of a very vital and important issue. And, you know, when you've been involved in a conflict for so long, the resonance of that conflict is going to be 3, 4, 5 times as long. And we're talking about 10, 11 years now for, you know, British involvement. Obviously, in Afghanistan, there's been an even longer experience of this there as well. It's a very good question, but I think I think writers quite often don't know, you know, why they follow a certain course. I've always believed that we write to understand. That's certainly one of the main reasons that I write. If I feel I have the answer, I'm not interested. So I think I'm certainly writing to understand. I feel that there's an element of responsibility just as a citizen. I think perhaps in the past, actually, I've sometimes wondered about the role of a writer. I certainly would never say that every writer should be writing important social active sort of issues. No, of course, every writer, their main job is just to be very good at writing and to write a good story and a good poem. But I think I've always worried slightly about that, and I've always wanted to have a slightly more socially involved role. And I think perhaps that these projects, when they presented themselves, they offered an opportunity for me to feel that as a writer, you are becoming a medium for other people's stories. It's not all coming from in here. It's not entirely self-generated. And so I think actually personally, that has been important for me, yeah.
Thank you. We have time for one last question, if you have one. Thanks.
Gracias. Buenos días.
Buenos días.
Quiero preguntar si en su obra existe la intención de evidenciar la responsabilidad que la sociedad está trasladando a los jóvenes. Lo digo porque la obra de la que vimos el corto en este momento habla sobre la guerra y vemos que la mayor parte de la gente que va a la guerra es gente supremamente joven. Por lo menos es lo que la percepción que uno tiene. Y pues también la obra que usted menciona que ha terminado, Canon, habla sobre un equipo de rugby, donde en estos equipos deportivos, obviamente, pues también hay gente muy joven. Y también lo digo porque anoche en el evento de poesía, usted una de las poesías que a mí me gustó mucho es Aún no mi madre,
sí.
Que me pareció muy linda, pero usted menciona a su mamá cuando aún era muy jovencita, 17 años. No sé si lo que se pretende realmente es hacernos ver que nosotros como sociedad estamos trasladando a los más jóvenes las responsabilidades más grandes. La guerra, el entretenimiento y la maternidad y la paternidad.
Qué buena pregunta, gracias. So, the question is whether you feel you want to show that society is giving its most its sort of heaviest duties to young people. So war, entertainment, and also sort of maternity. The links you were making were Charlie F. The rugby book, and also the poem about your mother, which you read at the Poetry Gala last night. So is it your intention to show that it falls to the young to carry these responsibilities?
Wow.
¿Verdad? Sí. Bueno, no sé si entendió lo que traduje, pero más o menos sí.
I did say that you write to understand. I think sometimes you do these so that you can understand, because I think that's the first time I've thought about that, but maybe you're right, yes. No. I think it's certainly something that drives under all of these recent projects. I am very interested in that concept of age. You know, it's well known. I think, you know, people have said it in various ways that, you know, that if it was only men over 40 who were allowed to go and fight, there wouldn't be as many wars. You know.
Also, we'd lose.
Sorry.
Also, we'd lose.
Well, yeah. Well, except that. On both sides, you know. But it is a very interesting question. I'm not sure I've got an answer, because I suppose, to be honest, it wasn't something that I was aware of at the front of my mind. But in all of these situations, it is a huge amount of pressure being put upon, you know, these very young shoulders. And it's not just youth, actually. The other element is where these people come from in society. I'm sure that Britain is quite similar to other countries, where the majority of our armies come from the poorer parts of the country. I'm very aware that in the more industrial towns in Wales, you get many, many, you know, army recruiting officers, and you don't see as many of those places in the richer areas. And so that was something else I know that I wanted to talk about, because it's not just the pressures we're putting on these people, but these are quite often people, because society has already dealt them a very difficult time, they're very badly prepared to cope with these pressures. So it's like we're piling on the troubles. And it also makes it very cyclical. I said earlier that, you know, most of the people I was working with, unfortunately, their marriages had broken up, the children were being affected, so then their schooling is affected. And you can see this, you know, this script. And it's the same with so many issues. I think one of our jobs is to ask the question, how do you break that cycle? How do you stop it happening again, generation after generation? In terms of the poem about my mother, which I always think of very fondly in terms of Cartagena, I first read it here on this stage, and there was a wonderful response. I came out to the front, and this lovely, very large woman came up to me and said, I am a Colombian, I am a mother from all the mothers in Colombia. Wonderful. It was the best response to a poem I've ever had.
You've never recovered since.
No, it was great. It's great. But I suppose, I mean, everyone has a very strong, or, you know, lots of people have a very strong connection with their mothers. But you're quite right that when I was looking at what was happening to these rugby players, when I was looking at what was happening to these soldiers, you can't help but think about their mothers. You have to.
Thank you. Oh, well, on that very moving note, I think we will end.
Okay, muchas gracias. Thank you so much, Deb.
Don't forget that Owen will be here to sign books afterwards. And thank you for coming.